You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And now on Community Connections, we change the pace a little bit after having spoken to Heidi. And being the second Wednesday of the month, it's always our legal hour with Hutchinson Legal. I have with you Madeleine. Madeleine hasn't been with us for a couple of years. I think we must have frightened her off. No, that's not true. And actually, welcome the two of you.
Hello, Alan.
Hello, Alan. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's good to have you too. Now, we sent you off with a question, and I've got another question on the same subject again. I think this is going to be with us for some time, and that's bail. So, first of all, can you tell us a bit about the bail? About what I just can't quite remember what the actual question was
last time. I have to say, Ellen, I'm not a criminal lawyer.
Yep.
But so that's my disclaimer.
Grant's already put the disclaimer up for you.
Exactly. But I've learned a lot in 24 hours, I have to say. Phil Hayes is our criminal lawyer. You'll have to get him in next, and he can really explain the whole situation. But there's a prima facie entitlement to bail unless two tests apply to certain offences. So basically the premise is you are entitled to bail, and you get two bites at the cherry, one when you're charged and one at before the hearing. After that, you have to have very special circumstances, which I'll go into in a minute.
Yep.
But there are, so for always the prosecution has the right to say that you present an unacceptable risk, and that if you would endanger the safety or welfare of any person or commit an offence on bail, interfere with a witness or otherwise obstruct the course of justice or fail to answer bail, then the prosecution will argue you're not entitled to it. But otherwise, for Schedule 1 offences, which include murder and all the serious treason, terrorist activity, aggravated burglary, aggravated carjacking, for all of those, the onus is on the accused to show that exceptional circumstances exist where they should be allowed bail. So we've got normal offences, yes, you're allowed bail unless the prosecution says you're an unacceptable risk. Schedule 1 offences, very serious offences, you have to show exceptional circumstances to justify bail. And for Schedule 2 offences, which are the sort of lesser manslaughter... Manslaughter is Schedule 2. Homicide, homicide by firearm, causing serious injury. It's like a level 2 serious charge,
yep,
section of offences, then you have to show that there are compelling reasons why you should be granted bail. So it's the bottom offences of just driving negligently or, you know, the run-of-the-mill offences, you are entitled to bail. That's the bottom line.
Yep.
Unless all these other factors come in.
All right. So... Yeah. The other question, which we asked, I think, was how often are you entitled to bail?
Yeah, well, that's twice. Not for the same offence.
No, I'm talking about because some of these people are on bail 10, 12 times.
For different offences, yes.
Well, some of them are the same offences.
No, for the same offence, it's only twice.
No, but that's that's each charge.
Yes,
but then
yes.
Some of them have got other charges against them, haven't they?
Yes. I think each charge is treated separately. But even if they are refused, so they're only allowed twice,
yeah,
for the one
charge.
And then only after that, if they satisfy the court that new facts or circumstances have arisen since the refusal or revocation of bail, or the applicant was not represented by a legal practitioner when bail was refused or revoked, or the order refusing or revoking bail was made by a bail justice. So, yeah, if further circumstances come to light, they will look at it again. But I think you're right. Overall, it does seem to be an entitlement. And there was a new law passed last year which said that a bail decision maker must not refuse bail if the person accused only of offences against the Summary Offences Act that are not referred to in Schedule 3.
Well, that would be pretty low.
Pretty low, that's right.
All right, look, we'll take a break and we'll be back with more.
To lawyers, grapes and gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And of course, we will be discussing bail again next month, because I've got some more questions to send away with these people to, I just think the bail is going to be a topical subject for the next few months that we're going to get inquiries on them, because I know a lot of people out there have a disquiet about them. But what I must say is, when Hutchison League are in, we're not asking them for their opinion, we are asking them for what the law states, and that's where we are. So I know somebody rang up last month irate about what they were told, but it is the law. We aren't talking about what the particular lawyer thinks, we're asking about the law. But anyway, let's get on. You've got a newsletter you want to talk about.
Well, yes. We decided to concentrate on the topics that are in our newsletter. Yep. And we put this newsletter out quarterly, and anyone's welcome to call into our office at 38 New Street, Ringwood, if they want a copy, or even I've left some out on your reception there. Yep. For anyone. So one of the topics was the major changes which are coming to the aged care system. This has been on the cards since the Royal Commission which started in October of 2018 and finished in March 2021, and put out a huge amount of recommendations as to how we can lift our game in
quality.
Looking after, yes, lift the quality of looking after the elderly. There's been a lot of complaints about restraints and chemical and physical restraints and neglect and abuse and so forth. And
quality of food?
Yes, that's right. The Ombudsman is still being inundated with complaints from year to year, but the government's determined to lift the quality, and Akshay is going to talk about what this new act will actually try to do.
So basically what took place in 2018, so that was proposed to address concerns that the current Aged Care Act was more structured around the providers and the funding that was being provided to rest homes and aged care facilities, rather than having the focus purely on the elderly and their rights. And basically the rights contained, which are being proposed in this new legislation that will be enacted at the end of 2024, hopefully, basically are the statement of rights, which are not directly enforceable, but instead become enforceable when there is a complaint or non-compliance by the providers. So the statement of rights in the exposure draft includes rights such as equitable access, independence, autonomy of elderly people, the freedom of choice of elderly people as well, and more of a person-centered communication and approach, and also the respect for privacy and several other rights as well. So this rights-based approach focuses more on the elderly, so they are encouraged and empowered to exercise their rights, rather than having an approach that's more based on funding and providers as well. So basically that encompasses the new statutory duty of aged care. So the exposure draft also included a new statutory duty to be proposed to providers to ensure, as far as reasonably and practicable and considering the rights of elderly people, breaching this duty will occur if there is a serious failure to act in a way that is consistent with the duty, or inconsistent with the duty, should I say. Serious breaches will attract criminal penalties as well as civil penalties when the provider fails to take reasonable steps. And the failure of that duty can be on the basis, for example, which results in a risk of serious illness, serious injury, or even death of an individual to whom the duty is owed. Compensation pathways would also be available to the individual, and also to families who have suffered serious illness or injury, and the providers are found guilty of the offence as well. Yeah.
All right, so it really starts to protect the people in the home more so than the owners of the home, doesn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes. And to raise the accountability of the owners.
And I think it also provides the clear rights which the elderly people will have as well. So, for example, we touched on autonomy as well and freedom of choice. That's allowing the elderly to choose which activities they want to partake in, what food, for example, as well, and just basic individual human rights which humans should have.
Because I think Madeleine broached on it before, there have been accusations, haven't they, of people being strapped to beds for hours on end because they just got up and walked around and it didn't suit the provider and things like that, hasn't there?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it is a very difficult job to look after someone who can't look after themselves.
Yep.
But it's to stop shortcuts being taken, make sure staffing levels are right, so that people can be cared for properly.
I mean, that's been said a few times, isn't it, that sometimes they, and I'm not saying they're true, but that people have been given drugs at night to sleep, put them to sleep, because there just weren't enough people to look after them. I'm not saying any of that's true. I'm just saying that's been said.
That is one of the areas that this Act aims to address, is the restraint, physical and chemical restraint, practices. Yeah.
I've got to take a quick break. We'll be back with more.
listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back. And we're talking to the team from Hutchinson Legal, Madeleine and sorry about that. I didn't mean to mess that up.
That's right.
Now we're going to talk about granny flats in the backyard.
Yes. So, as everyone knows, granny flats are an independent building from the main residence where traditionally elderly or disabled people might live. But in September 2023, it was announced that granny flats no longer require a planning permit if they're less than 60 square metres. So
yep.
that makes them easier to build and without as much red tape to go through. They still require a building permit, and I'm denying liability in all areas today. I'm not a property lawyer. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I know it's easier if you don't require two permits.
Yeah, but the first one's a planning permit, isn't it? So that means you've just got to get a permit to actually plan it, and then the second one is a building permit.
That's
so
right. There you
the
go.
First one you don't need because you don't have to put... With a planning permit, I understand you've got to tell everybody around you what you're planning on doing.
All of that. So you don't need
I'm not a lawyer either.
No,
but
thank you. You that was very helpful.
No, I'm not sure because I'm not a lawyer.
but that's what you don't need anymore. So different councils have different requirements, but they typically require that the granny flat is movable. And is only used to accommodate a person dependent on a resident of the main dwelling.
So that means basically, doesn't it, that if the person that family member that's in there, if they move on in various ways, I don't think you can just let them in, can you? I think then they no longer become a granny flat.
Well, yeah, that's. As I understand it, different councils have different requirements, but a lot of them do require you to move it. Often on selling, they don't necessarily want it there either. So, I think they require the possibility of it being relocated.
I think it's only viable while it's a family member.
That's right.
Either elderly or disabled. If you can't, you can't just turn around then and decide that you're going to let it.
That's right. So, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the fact that Centrelink recognises granny flats as an asset that they will take into account in assessing your.
Oh, do they?
Your pension, yes. Oh. And they have various requirements, but they will take that into account as not taking part of, not forming part of your assets.
Oh, not part of your asset.
No, it'll be the same as a principal place of residence.
Yep.
But there usually has to be a formal agreement in place, and that's the other thing I wanted to stress, that when people are handing over hundreds of thousands of dollars to one adult child to live in their backyard, they really need a formal agreement, setting out the terms of that agreement and what happens if it all goes wrong and they want to leave, how do they get their money back? All of those sorts of things need to be thought about, and even taking it a step further, the estate planning aspects, if that one child benefits from the granny flat or from the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Now, I know you are well equipped to talk about wills because that's one of your specialities.
That one I do admit to.
So you can't actually pass on a granny flat in a will, could you? If it's
No, that's right. That's right. So you need to make... unless it can be valued as a separate entity that's going to be relocated elsewhere... It will belong to that property unless it's moved.
If you then want to move on, then the granny flat has to go, doesn't it?
Well, it depends what the agreement is, and that's why it's so important to think about all those things first.
Yep.
before you hand over hundreds of thousands of dollars. Very important to think about those things. Is it going to stay? Is it going to move? Is this child's property going to be enhanced by those couple of hundred thousand dollars? Do I need to think about my other children and make provision for them in my will that they didn't get, and so on? And then for Centrelink purposes, it's good to be able to show them, here's the deed. It's almost like a title. Here's the deed of family arrangement, which gives me that right to stay in the granny flat.
Sounds good. Yeah. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Grant, if you happen to be listening. Now, you want to talk about titles, house titles, so I guess we talk about?
Thank you.
And Wayne?
So anyone who's been in their house for 50 years or so, or even 20 years, will have one of the beautiful old parchment titles with beautiful writing, and that if they go way back, they really are a work of art.
Yep.
And I think in the last 20 years or so, the plain blue pages came in, so they weren't as attractive or impressive, but you still did get a paper title. But over the last 3 years, they've been the land titles registration system has been phased out and is going electronic, and a new system, which I think must have been devised by lawyers because it requires a lawyer to operate it, or a conveyancer, a licensed conveyancer. Yep. And that is that it's done electronically. The transfer of land is electronic, and the solicitor or conveyancer ends up with what's called control of the title. And until recently, a paper title could be issued, or just a piece of paper could be issued which showed that the solicitor had the control of the title. But as of 3 August this year, there are no more paper titles available at all, ever, ever.
Every inch is going to go digital.
That every title is now... when there's a new transaction, it will convert to electronic.
Well, it's a bit the same. I've had an email from Vic Rhodes saying that they're not going to be issuing licences anymore, that they'll be electronic.
Amazing. That's right. That's the way of the world these days.
Well, from what I understand, they did that at Ballarat. It was a huge failure because something went wrong.
What happened?
I don't know. Oh. But they couldn't access them. Something went wrong.
Well, I think if anything happens to our computers, then it's a problem. But
well, the problem I see is with the phones, because if you don't have a phone or if you lose your phone, then I don't know what you're going to do, because it's going to be a problem.
Then we're all going to the cloud.
And if the cloud blows away. All right, I've got to take another quick break.
I paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes made a few.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Right, now we've got a question for you to take away, and surprise, 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 it's on bail again, because we've had two or three questions since our last, since you were here last month. Now, we want to, the listener wants to know, what sort of crimes can you get bail for? And part of this, I know Madeleine answered before, but we want to break that out a bit more, and the crimes that you can't get bail for. Now, I think Madeleine probably covered that pretty well with murder and Category 1 or whatever it was. We want to know at what age you can, what's the youngest you can get bail? And it's not no point in asking what's the oldest in bail at all, because, I mean, obviously you can get it as old as anybody is silly enough to commit a crime. So, first of all, what ages can you get it? What crimes can you not get bail for? And also, Madeleine brought it up before, compelling reasons now that you should get bail. So what sort of things are we talking about are compelling reasons? We don't want an answer today. Next month will do us. But what are compelling reasons? Now, I don't want to suggest things, but if it was a lady who's pregnant, would that be a compelling reason, or looking after a disabled child or something? Just a rough idea. Not every sort of thing that it is, but just a rough outline as what compelling reasons would be, because it seems to me that, I'll take me out of it. It seems that from our listeners, it doesn't seem to be hard to get bail, and they seem to think that bail should be harder to get. And is there no longer a crime, breach of bail? Because that used to be a crime. It was breach of bail, and you could get charged with that. Nobody's heard of anybody being charged with that in a long while. So could you have a quick look and see whether breaching bail is still a crime? Or I have a feeling it might have been done away with.
No, it is. It is still a crime to breach bail conditions.
But then you come back. How come somebody can have 20... breaches of bail and still not having the bail revoked? Yeah. I've stunned everyone. All right, look, we'll take another quick break. We don't want to keep on with bail, but look, I think we're going to... I'm only here to ask the questions that the listeners want to know, and I know there's quite a few are starting to sort of wonder about bail. But anyway, look, I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to listen to Slim Dusty, and I think everybody around that's anybody's heard Slim Dusty with a pub with no beer, but this one's called The Answer to a Pub with No Beer.
Where the hills roll away from a small country town, there are hearts filled with sorrow as the word spreads around. And the jackass won't laugh, 'cause there's no jokes to hear. So let me tell you the reason for the pub with no beer. Broken down on the track, for she stripped every gear, stands the old grey Blitz wagon, the one with the beer. And the driver's near mad, standing scratching his ear. He knows just what they're thinking at the pub with no beer. When the drover rides out and draws rein by the truck, he joins in with the driver and curses their luck. Where's Billy the blacksmith? We could do with him here, but Bill moved on to Grafton, where the brewery stands near. So the drover rides back with a brilliant idea. He rides hard in the saddle till the town's drawing near. He dismounts in the lane and the dog cringes near, as the swaggy's just leaving the pub with no beer. There's excitement all round as the drover tells where the old Blitz is busted on the plains way out there. Every man that can ride, says the drover to all, saddle up, let's get moving, and we'll bring back the haul. When the boys rode back in, what a strange sight they made. They charged into the town like the old light brigade. With tow ropes and tackle, they all pulled as one, and the old Blitz moved fast. faster than she ever had done. Soon the kegs were rolled in, one was placed on the bar. They filled all the glasses, every jug and each jar. Soon the word passed around, and they all gave a cheer. And there was laughter once more in the pub with no beer.
And that was a great Slim Dusty, but as I say, everybody plays a pub with no beer, but not very often to get you the answer. There are actually two answers, which I might play. The other one, one's called The Answer, The Pub With No Beer, and the other one's a sequel to A Pub With No Beer. You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 9 minutes to 2:12 degrees. So we've hit the top for the day. A few weeks ago, this would have been an absolute low for the night. But anyway, Madeleine, you're here. We know that you're involved with wills, so it would be a waste of my time and your time not to talk to you about wills.
And with no notice, I know it's coming.
Yeah, I know, but you know all this stuff. We've talked about power attorneys before and what they do and all that, but we've never, ever discussed what sort of attributes you should be looking for in a person. Now, I know a lot of people use lawyers, and you're going to tell me you should have a lawyer, but and that's fine, and I accept that. But if you don't want a lawyer, if you want a friend or somebody that you trust, what should you be looking for in them?
You mean as an executor?
As an executor, yeah. Or a power of attorney?
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question, and I actually wouldn't recommend that you have a lawyer in the first instance. That's more for people who really have absolutely nobody else in their life.
Yep.
So for an executor, I would different attributes than for a power of attorney, but for an executor, they don't even have to have a great financial knowledge or administrative skills or whatever, because they can always get the lawyer to do the work. But it's someone who will make sure that your wishes are carried out in accordance with the will. And basically, there's not that much discretion involved. They have to follow your wishes as set out in the will, but they can decide things like whether to not sell a house for a year or so and to rent it out or whatever. And you want someone who will consider all your family's interests in that regard and not cause trouble.
And I guess one of the things, though, an executor, it's not a lot of good to pick someone who's older than yourself because they might have gone before you go.
Yeah, well, that is something to factor in. What's the likelihood of them, you outlasting them?
Yep.
In which case you can always appoint someone else and always appoint a substitute executor, so that if anything happens to the instituted one. But something I will say, a lot of people say, oh, I only want one child, or I don't want my children, I want somebody else. Unless there's a reason not to have all your children, I recommend you have all your children as executors. You can have up to four people can get probate, or one can apply and the other three can step back. But there's nothing worse than a parent dying and one child having all the control and everybody feeling left out. That does cause problems in families.
Yes.
So I would recommend having all your children.
Right. Power of attorney. What should you be looking for in a person with power of attorney?
That is a person you trust absolutely, who knows you really well and who will make the same decisions as you would have made in a situation. And the worst situation, or the main situation you should visualise, is having a stroke or dementia and having to be put into care, in which case what sort of decisions would that person make, and having access to your finances. And so would they make good decisions for you, the types of decisions you'd decide for yourself, and of course preserve your finances for your benefit.
So is there a benefit in having a family member, or would you be better to look outside the family?
No, I think it's always better to have a family member. Oh. And it's a really sad day when there's no family member that you can trust. Oh. But some people are in that situation.
What happens if you've got two children? One says, pull the plug. let them go. And the other one says no.
Okay, so fortunately in that situation you can only have one at a time and you must appoint them in order of...
Oh, can you? Only one.
That's right. Yeah. And so it's a, you can have a list, but the doctors will work through the list and only speak to one person at a time. So that person will have the power.
So would that... Hang on, I just want to get this clear. So we'll say you've got four, but when you say the doctor will work through them, he won't go and ask the four different people what their answers are.
No,
he'll
no.
ask number one.
He'll ask number one. If they're not available, he'll move to number two.
Yep.
If they're not available, he'll move to number three. But he'll only speak to one person at a time. And the first person you nominate has the most power, so presumably they will be available and will make the decisions.
So you need to be very careful who you appoint as number one, don't
you? Absolutely. So that's a medical treatment decision maker we're talking about.
Yep.
And in the case of financial and personal, which is the other power of attorney, you can have children acting jointly, jointly and severally, by a majority of three, or any combination, and you can have restrictions on them. But jointly is probably the safest.
So there's a difference between the two power of attorneys, isn't there? Because the first one, the medical, you can only have one.
That's right. Completely different documents, completely different legislation, completely different powers. So medical is if you're in hospital and you can't give instructions to the doctor about your medical treatment, and financial and personal is for your general financial arrangements and living arrangements.
Oh, right. So... I guess you've got to be pretty careful who you pick on all of them, though, don't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely.
So when you're saying power of attorney, well, or you reckon in certainly particularly with well, basically all the power of attorneys, the two different power of attorneys and the estate should all be, hopefully, children, your own children.
That's the optimum. If you've got children who you trust and care about them... they care about you. That's the best position to be in, to have fit adult children who can make these decisions.
All right, so I'm going to play the devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
So you've got a house and one child says, I think we should hang on for 12 months because we're going to get more for it in 12 months, and one says, no, I want the money now. How's that resolved?
So if they're appointed jointly...
Yep.
They just have to come to an agreement, and if they absolutely can't, they can go to VCAT to get VCAT to decide.
Oh, so VCAT will decide.
Yeah, and they can even get a review, an opinion from VCAT, actually adjudicate between that sort of a dispute if it gets that bad, if they can't resolve it themselves. But if they're appointed jointly, and this is why it's so important to know your children, and you can predict.
Whatever happens, two or three or four, not much two, say you've got three, four or five, whatever it might be, and you know two are probably going to go one way and the other three just can't stand the other three, the other two, so they're going to go the other way. Would you be better then to give... I'm only trying to be the devil advocate.
Yeah.
Would you be better to give it to one, or how would you go there?
Possibly, or the two that you think would make the decisions you want made, and then have the others as alternates. So appoint the people you actually trust the most to make the decisions, and they just, if they have more power than the alternates, then that's too bad. So if you had five children and you only really could rely on two, you'd appoint those two jointly, and then they could keep an eye on each other.
There's a bit of a minefield in some of these, isn't there?
Yeah, and you do need to navigate it all carefully and get proper advice. But quickly, one thing I will say, which a lot of people don't know, is the power of attorney authority ends on death and the executor begins on death. So there's no overlap.
Oh, isn't there?
No, none whatsoever.
All right. Look, I've got to go. The 2 o'clock news is knocking on the door. Thanks for coming, and it's great to see the both of you. And we'll
Thank
see
you,
somebody
Alan.
Next month.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.